get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99th percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about Trump and free trade. Everybody knows that Trump has been focusing on the white working class, particularly middle-aged and older, and he's making some big cuts into Hillary's support in that particular critical segment. And that segment may play a determining role in these key states in the election. What are the key states? So Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio. And if Mr. Trump can leverage that discontent with that group, he just may pull off those states. Recent poll shows he's leading already in those states. He's leading Clinton by 3 points in Florida, 2 points in Pennsylvania, and they're tied in Ohio, and they haven't even started debating yet. This thing could be all over with the results of the first debate. I think Hillary should be very concerned about what's going on. And really, it's a reflection of the Democratic Party abandoning the working class in this country. Yes, the Democratic Party orients towards certain ethnic groups, identity politics, but, you know, this is the end of identity politics, I believe. We're turning back to hard-nosed economic class politics. That doesn't mean identity politics are irrelevant, no. It just means that we have this other element that is surging. And we saw it in the Brexit vote, which we've talked about, over in the UK. Interesting relationships between identity, which in that case is reflected in the immigration issue, and working class, hard-nosed economic, standard of living, wages, jobs, safety net politics and issues. All right, so we're going to talk about Trump and free trade here, because free trade has become a kind of a proxy issue here for broader working class economic discontent. The two have become linked. And the linking of the trade issue, free trade, offshoring, and so forth, with the decline in standard of living is the big problem for the ruling elites. They didn't expect this to happen, but it has happened, and it has happened globally. We talked about it in the UK issue, but now you know, let's talk about it in the US issue here. Before we get to Trump, though, I want to give a little bit of an update on global economic trends and issues that need to be watched, because we are at a transitional stage in the global economy here. And I think that transition is going to, within the next 6 to 12 months, flip over to a more serious economic situation following the U.S. election. Anyway, we'll be talking about that more, but let's provide a little bit of a review of some key sectors of the global economy and how that is obviously connected with this whole trade, global trade and free trade issue, and therefore connected to the election in the United States through the growing discontent with the free trade agreements that Trump has raised and Sanders raised, and forcing Hillary to adapt to, and causing U.S. economic elites all kinds of heartburn they're kind of growing increasingly worried about this, almost panicking in some cases, you know, all the way from the business roundtable guys to politicians and others, which we'll talk about. But they're growing increasingly concerned about the relationship between what appears to be populist rebellion and globalization. You know, globalization is kind of a code word for trade and free trade. So when they talk about the problems of globalization and discontent with globalization, they're really, you know, trying to cover up the real term here. You know, globalization is kind of an amorphous kind of a term, but free trade and trade is more specific, you see. That's how the ideology works. You know, you confuse and obfuscate the real concepts and the real terms. But anyway, they're growing increasingly concerned. So let's look at, you know, peel the onion here, go from the global situation and global trade to protectionism, which is what the elites are fearful of, and from there to the issue of what's going on in the U.S. elections here, which we'll be watching more closely and talking about. Okay, let's look at China. Well, before we do that, let's step back and say, wow, what's happening with the U.S. stock market, right? Going through the roof once again. 18,500 on the Dow, you know, the NASDAQ, and S&P 500 all at record levels. What the heck is happening here? Well, it's just the final surge, euphoria, before we get a major correction. Look, we've had two major corrections this year. At the beginning of the year, fear over China and global oil slowdown and all related issues looked like the U.S. stock markets, the global markets, were going to go into a tailspin. And they did for a while, but then they came right back. Oh, and then we had all the Brexit concern here, and same thing. But then they came right back. This kind of volatility and the swings being greater than average and normal are an indicator of churning at the top of these financial markets. And just heard today that some of the leading world financial investors warning that this is a false top here, that this is not going to last, and they're pulling out. But, you know, the herd investors just keep running after yield and profits, financial asset profits, and that's when they get stuck. You know, those are the people who end up paying the bill. The smart guys get out, and they're getting out. This may be another false top. There could even be a third false top here before the election, but U.S. elections. You know, you got the U.K. elections, you got U.S. elections, and next year you got France, you got Germany, Netherlands, right? We've had elections in Spain, but they can't get their act together there and get a government, etc. You know, it's everywhere. There's growing signs of volatility and instability. And that's not a good sign for markets. And I think once the markets are convinced that they've had their last and best false top, that we'll see a major correction of 10, 20% here. Okay, looking at China, right? Capital Economics has come out with independent research, market research, global market research firm, come out with an estimate that China GDP is growing at only 4.5%, not the 6.67% that China is claiming. The currency is being reflected. Chinese currency, yuan, is now at the bottom of a range. You know, it's trades in only a range. And it's at the bottom of that range, meaning it's pushing. More events, developments in China, the world economy will push it through that range, and we'll get another de facto devaluation of that currency, which will set off competitive currency wars even worse than they are at present. And we got a property bubble going on there. You know, Chinese economy clearly was slowing last year. And what did China do? It said, well, okay, we've got to tame the stock bubble here. And so we'll let a property bubble return. And then you've got this property, and there was construction recovery in China and so far this year. And that's propped up the GDP. But the real investment in plant and equipment, fixed capital and so forth, has been continually declining in China. And that's a better indicator. And in China, right now you've got a kind of a split recession. Certain parts of the country and economy, depending on old industrial production for export and so forth, are clearly in a recession. And other parts, newer parts of the economy that have to do with finance and services and maybe some light electronic manufacturing have been doing well. So it's like a geographic recession, only in certain locales, because it's such a big economy, you know, geographically. Same thing in the U.S. You get these regional recessions that aren't really fully reflected in the total indicators. Okay, so what is China doing now? Well, as I said, it's promoting a property bubble here again as a way of dealing, you know, just sort of whack-a-mole bubbles here, diverting the stock market bubble to the property bubble, which, you know, the stock market bubble was a product of policies in 2014-15 by China to divert speculative finance from what was the property bubble before that. And that, you know, led to the stock market bubble, and now taming the stock market bubble, instead of allowing the money to flow offshore in capital flight, which it was after last August, and the bubble crashed in stocks there, keep the money in China and let it go back into property and construction is what the strategy has been. Well, you know, that's not a real fundamental strategy. So what China has been doing is to try to prop up its economy with global exports and trade, and we'll talk about that, global trade slowing, how else are they going to do it? They can't do it just on property. So they're focusing on massive fiscal stimulus in their state-owned enterprise sector. In other words, let's get the state-owned enterprises to invest in infrastructure, big infrastructure boom here going on. You know, the state-owned enterprises constitute 35% of all fixed investment in China. It's a big, big sector, right? And that's the sector that, by the way, is having the greatest problems with corporate debt. So there's a dual strategy here by the Chinese going on to try to rescue these state-owned enterprises and get them to simultaneously help boost the economy with infrastructure stimulus. Right. The state-owned enterprises are responsible for almost three-fourths of all infrastructure investment. So there's a fiscal policy of infrastructure spending that constitutes the heart of this new stimulus in China to keep the economy from slowing even faster than it is. You know, we've been talking about infrastructure over here in the U.S., and they will eventually turn to that, too. And in Europe, the same thing, infrastructure fund. The elites don't really like to go that route, unless they absolutely have to. They prefer monetary policy because it puts more bucks in their pocket, especially bankers and finance people. So they prefer monetary policy, and that's what they've been relying on in Europe and in the U.S. But at some point, they're going to have to go, and they're creeping towards also some kind of fiscal stimulus, probably infrastructure. And we'll see that after the elections here in the U.S. And probably in the U.K. Now that's also going into a recession. And after their election, I think you'll see more infrastructure spending. Fiscal spending, so forth. The U.S. needs to stimulate its economy with fiscal infrastructure spending in order to have an excuse to raise interest rates, you see. And they're desperate to raise interest rates before the next recession. I don't think they're going to make it, the Federal Reserve. But anyway, I guess I'm predicting we're going to see infrastructure fiscal stimulus coming after the elections. At least some of that, how much, you know, remains to be seen. But that's what China is doing right now. You know, China is, among all the major sectors of the global economy, has been less reluctant to engage in fiscal stimulus, and therefore the economy has done much better. And now we have this state-owned enterprise infrastructure stimulus policy going on, added to the construction, return to a construction property building policy. And that's those two things are what's keeping the Chinese economy from collapsing even further. Right. Okay, so what's happening in Japan? Interesting developments here as well. What we have, clearly, is that in Japan, for the first time, it's become obvious, excuse me, that Abenomics has been a complete failure, and we are on the verge of an Abenomics 2 coming. The ruling party in Japan of Shinzo Abe has recently had elections and has won a majority, even though it has this terrible track record, by promising that it's going to engage in more fiscal stimulus after totally relying on monetary policy. You know, we're on this verge of a shift from this total reliance on monetary policy to the elites attempting some fiscal stimulus, because the monetary policy is no longer having any effect. You know, in Japan, the whole idea was to stimulate with QE, quantitative easing, and negative interest rates, which is the case, and hopefully drive down the currency and stimulate exports as a result. That's the whole strategy. And, of course, in the meantime, you enrich the finance capital elite with capital gains of all kinds in stock markets, etc. That's what QE has been all about. Well, QE, in fact, has been deteriorating. So the central bank in Japan, Bank of Japan, has embarked on a policy of not only buying government bonds, but buying corporate bonds, private sector bonds, which have increased significantly. They keep upping that program there. And now they're buying private corporate bonds and buying private stocks and private property assets. The Central Bank of Japan is buying everything. Not just bonds, you see. I mean, it's a revolution in central banking going on, and it means central banks are migrating towards a kind of private bank. You know, they're supposed to be just a quasi-government bank that stabilizes the system by buying and selling government bonds, pumping money into the economy that way. Well, that doesn't work very well for some time now. So QE has migrated in Japan and in Europe as well to buying private assets, private corporate bonds, and in Japan, as I said, buying property assets, real estate investment trust funds and ETFs and stocks. They're propping up the whole financial system, buying everything to keep it from collapsing. We'd already be in another financial collapse, and they cannot keep us from that forever if it weren't for these central banks rescuing all the financial assets by buying more and more and more. Okay, so there's talk of Abenomics 2, and that will also include some kind of fiscal stimulus. Because real investment has been collapsing. This whole monetary policy, financial approach, does not do much, as I've said time and again, for real asset investment, you know, in plant and equipment and so on and so forth. The money gets diverted into financial assets, or gets hoarded, or sent abroad. You know, that's the main theme for my book, Systemic Fragility in Global Economy. One of the main themes. And it's pretty clear now, after 7 years, that they can't get real investment going, and therefore the real economy and monetary policy has run its course, pretty much. Even though they get more and more desperate, even driving bond rates into negative territory, you see. It's the end of the road for that. The contradictions of monetary policy are beginning to outweigh the positive financial and currency intended results. Real investment in Japan, despite this massive, massive QE and negative interest rate policy, has fallen. Down 8% over the past year, and exports are down 30%. You know, and the currency up 17%. Well, the currency is supposed to decline when you pump all this money into the economy. Well, it's going up because there are other global forces here involved, including other countries who are out QEing Japan QE. Everybody can play that QE game, you see. And we're going to see even more in the UK now, right? Rates will be reduced, going to, well, negative territory even further, and there'll be more QE as they try a central bank monetary approach to rescue that economy now in the wake of Brexit. Right? So the point is, we'll have some kind of fiscal stimulus in Japan. It's coming as part of a new Abenomics 2, since the first one failed miserably. Right. How about Europe? Well, we have the same trend. The European Central Bank is buying more corporate bonds. $10 billion a month in non-bank corporate bond purchases. Negative interest coming on the tail of all that, of course. Even German 10-year bonds are now in negative territory. You know, negative bond rates are supposed to, theoretically, stimulate investment. In other words, if the banks have to pay the central bank to put their money there, the logic is that they will then, instead of having to pay and not make any money, they will turn and invest it. Well, but that whole logic is faulty. It's based upon classical, neoclassical economic theory called supply side, which argues that if you reduce, supply side theory says, reduce business costs, they will therefore invest, and investment will lead to more jobs and more income and recovery. Supply side, in other words, cut their costs, whether that means cutting interest rates or cutting wages or whatever, right? Cutting costs gives businesses more disposable income in which they, assumed falsely, will invest. That's supply side theory. Well, negative interest rates are a kind of supply side theory, which means raise the costs if banks and businesses have to leave their money with the central bank so that they'll have reduced costs if they don't put their money in the central bank and invest it instead, you see. But this is the same faulty logic. It's not going to lead to any real investment increase. You know, these policymakers and elites are victims of their own ideology. You know, they actually believe some of this stuff. Not all of them, but the more ignorant of them, and they're more ignorant than not, believe the nonsense of their own economic theories. They are victims of their own economic ideology, many of them. Okay, so Europe is doing the same thing. More negative rates, more corporate bond buying going on as well. We're in Europe, the EU, and we're going to see the same thing even more aggressively with the Bank of England in the UK. Right. But the Italian banks are the centerpiece of the crisis right now in Europe. Italian banks, $400 billion of non-performing bank loans. Right. And the big debate is over there, what are you going to do about this $400 billion of bad loans? They have to clean them up somehow. How are they going to clean them up? Well, that's what the debate is in Europe. The Renzi government wants to have the government bail out these banks. And it was taxpayer expense. Ah, but EU, European Union rules say that governments can't do that anymore. They did that, you know, during the crisis, and the banks dragged down the governments. You know, they had to be bailed out, and the governments bailed them out, and bailout really means you're taking the private sector debt onto your own government balance sheet. That's how governments get overloaded with debt. In Europe, that's been the case. I mean, a little old Greece, over $300 billion in debt, well over $300 billion, still after 7 years. How the hell did that happen? Well, it was because they bailed out the banks in the 2010 crisis, and then again when the second double-dipper recession, 2011-12, governments bailed out the banks. And European Commission and other European governments loaned Greeks the money, became Greek government debt, to bail out the private sector debt, you see. The private sector debt integrated with the government debt. And the banks get bailed out, and you know, shadow banks, hedge funds, and equity firms and so forth get bailed out, but all the debt sits on the government balance sheet. And then, you know, EU says to Greece, well, you got to have austerity to pay us now because we paid off the banks. And studies have shown that 96% or something like that, independent studies of all the bailouts in Greece have gone to private banks, ultimately. It's about bailing out the banks, you see. Well, we got a situation in Italy where $400 billion have to be bailed somehow. And the government's saying, well, you know, let's keep doing the same thing. Well, Renzi government wants to bail out the banks, but the European Commission says, no, that doesn't work. We did that before, remember? And private investors don't want to buy Italian bonds. So the talk is, well, looks like we have to do some haircuts and bail-ins, you know. Haircuts means bond investors take a loss, right? Their bonds are worth less than they paid for, even when they're bailed out. That means the bailout cost is not as great, right? But there's also talk, and they're putting a toe in the water, of what's called bail-ins. Bail-ins means junior bond holders and depositors, which is mom and pop depositors in these banks, will have to take a loss. In other words, bail in. We're going to take some of your deposits in the bank, and we're going to convert that to the worth of the stock of the bank. So, you know, what was actual cash you had is now stock, worth of stock. And Italian bank stock is going to fall. It's falling through the floor here. You know, the biggest bank, UniCredit, went down like, what, 30%? And the bank that's most in trouble, Monte dei Paschi, 45% in a matter of a couple of weeks. Stock price, bank stock price collapse, right? Which worsens the situation, you see. So the big debate is, do they do that? Do they convert your cash? At what level of deposits, $100,000 or less or more, force the depositors to bail out the bank so that the government, by EU law, cannot do it, doesn't do it? What's going to be the answer there? UniCredit, the big bank, has almost $100 billion in non-performing loans, and it's beginning to sell its assets. You know, these asset sales are always an indicator that so crisis coming, when they got to dump their good assets to raise money, right, to cover their losses, right? So how does this spread, right? If the financial assets, the stock of these banks collapses, does it have an effect on other asset prices? Yes, it does. Just as we're seeing in the UK, the property prices are collapsing now that had run up into a bubble level. They're collapsing, and it will spill over into other assets because the same people who own the one form of asset own the other, and they have to sell the other assets to pay off the losses in the property prices or in the bank stock and so forth. And that's how it spreads from one to the other. Then you have derivative prices that are impacted, and money has to be raised for that, and so they sell off other assets. This is how financial contagion occurs, you see. It starts, you know, in one or two specific areas, and it spreads to others. So that's what we're looking at right now in Europe. We'll watch that closely. Now, what does this all have to do with the U.S. election? Well, world trade is slowing down faster than they thought. And, you know, it's the first time in history that world trade is slower than world GDP. GDP meaning real growth, trade meaning, export-import across countries of the goods that are being produced. It's always been that trade, the growth in trade volumes has always been higher than the growth in GDP. But now it's inverted for the very first time. There's been no growth for 18 months in world trade, according to the Netherlands Bureau of Economic Analysis report just released. The slowdown in world trade is worse than reported. It's been flat since January 18. In fact, the level today, April 2016, as of April, is less than it was in January 15. So no growth in trade. Ah, but yet somehow the economy, world economy, is still growing. No growth in trade, and we got a slowdown in real investment going on everywhere globally. Productivity is negative everywhere, almost. Big problems, but yet, you know, the IMF and the World Bank say, oh, you know, the global economy is growing 3%. No, it's not. There's no way it can be growing at 3%. And as I pointed out in my book, Systemic Fragility, if you look at the whole history of these forecasts of global growth by World Bank and IMF, they're always overly optimistic. And for 5 years now, they've been reducing their forecasts and estimates. So, you know, you can't rely too much on those figures and those forecasts. So world trade is in a funk, no doubt about it. And the global economy is much closer to stagnant than it is a 2 or 3% growth rate. Well, this collapse in world trade really has the global elites worried. And what they're saying is, oh, there's too much protectionism, right? What is protectionism? That means countries trying to protect their home markets from imports coming in, and foreign investors and producers thus stealing production in their own domestic economy. Protectionism, that's what it is. You know, protectionism, tariffs, quotas, and other more bureaucratic means of preventing foreign imports having an effect on your economy. Protectionism. There's growing concern that there's rising protectionism. Right? Now, if the elites are worried about that, they're worried about Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is calling for more protectionism. Ah, but, you know, the slowing growth of trade is not just a question of protectionism. As I've argued, it's a question of fundamental changes in 21st century global capitalist economy, where there is a shift from real investment to more financial securities investment. It's what I call the financial investment shift. I have a whole chapter on that in my book, Systemic Fragility, right? That's responsible to a significant extent, not total, for the slowdown of world trade. Also, the collapse of oil commodity prices has resulted in less capital expenditures by companies in mining and oil and so forth, and certain business goods. And, of course, we could have a third cause here, just overproduction of goods, consumer goods, and so forth. Or, you know, overproduction might really be underconsumption due to the collapse of wage incomes and growing income inequality. So, you know, there's a lot of other explanations other than protectionism, tariffs, and so forth, for why world trade is collapsing, but you know, the elites want to focus on protectionism because the argument is, well, we got to have more free trade to offset the protectionism, and they don't want to focus on the other real causes for the slowdown in world trade. So anyway, you know, there's a big concern among ruling elites everywhere across the board that there's protectionism too much, and that Trump is playing on that, which, of course, he is. Because right now it's pretty clear that working classes, in the advanced economies at least, are beginning to associate their lack of economic growth in incomes with the trade issue. Globalization, if you want to call it that, or free trade, et cetera, right? They're associating it now, finally, after 7 years here, that, oh, you know, maybe maybe all these free trade agreements and related offshoring and so forth has something to do why I've lost my good manufacturing jobs, or I can't get any decent job here at a decent rate of pay anymore, or my kids are going to be condemned, it looks like, to low-paid service jobs for the rest of their lives, you know, and this is what have the working classes upset. We saw it in the Brexit, and it's what's behind the rise of populism, economic populism, Trump, Sanders, in the U.S. There's a fundamental economic condition that's the cause of this. You know, Donald Trump is not exciting people or inciting people, same thing with him, because there's no basis for what he says. There is a basis. Yeah, there was a basis for Sanders. Sanders was appealing to the younger and professional types, but Trump is appealing with his anti-trade positions to the white middle-aged and white working class. He's got his thumb on the discontent here, and the elites are worried he does, you see. They're worried about this economic populist rebellion that's focusing on trade issues in particular. And U.S. Business Roundtable, very important group in the U.S., made up of the largest corporations, responsible for $7 trillion in production and sales of 16 million workers in the U.S., right? Number one biggest business interest group here. They stay behind the scenes, but they're very influential, right? And they're totally upset. Everything has been upended, according to their CEO. You know, they're upset with Trump and his positions on free trade, which we will just shortly review here. And they're upset with Hillary, because Hillary has had to tack left and say, you know, well, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which at one time she supported, right, at one time, as the golden perfect free trade agreement. Now she's not so sure about that, right? Well, you know, she has to say that. I don't believe for a minute she's not a free trader. Of course she is, just like her husband, right? Just like Obama, just like George Bush. They're all been free traders, big time, and going deeper into free trade agreements as a way to enrich themselves and their economic elite friends. So, collapse in wages or stagnation in wages and real income in the U.S. has been is increasingly associated with free trade agreements, and Trump is pandering to that concern, and the elites are responding. Whoa, we got a problem here. You know, Penny Pritzker, U.S. Commerce Secretary, recently came out and talked about Trump. Ooh, bad. Bad for free trade. Trump is bad, right? Who's Pritzker? Well, Pritzker is the billionaire, Chicago billionaires, who put Obama in office, right? They groomed him one term in the state legislature, and then they pull him out and put him in the Senate and not even finish one term there, and then they throw him into the presidency. So they've clearly been able to push Obama. You know, they're the money behind Obama. So let's continue with our discussion here on our radio show. And talking about this situation here with Trump and free trade. Okay. All right. So, jobs, wages, trade, nexus is the reality of this election campaign. Voters recognize it. Elites are fearful about it. And Trump is pandering and exploiting it. Working class, U.S. working class, median incomes have been declining here at least 10% in the last decade, and somewhere around 6-7% since 2010. 14 million jobs that have been created. Obama's, you know, big deal about that, right? Over half of them are part-time temp, low-paid service jobs. And the forecast is 90% of all the jobs that are going to be created in the next decade are going to pay $36,000 or less. 90%. In other words, 50% of all the jobs since the crash have been low-paid jobs. And that's going to escalate to 90%. Same thing in Europe. Last year, 90% of all the jobs created were part-time temp jobs. You know, this is the new reality for the working class. Right? And, of course, part-time temp jobs, I mean, you have no benefits of any reasonable extent here, and you have no job security. And in the U.S., manufacturing jobs, we had 18 million in 2000 plus, and now we have barely 12 million. So 6 million manufacturing jobs alone have disappeared, not even talking about non-manufacturing jobs. And a lot of those jobs have been lost to free trade, you see. A lot of them, especially in manufacturing, but also in communications and in professional services and, electronic, IT, etc., have all been lost. And with those high-paying jobs, and with that, of course, a lot of the unions disappear. That's the reality. And it's partly the result of free trade. I say partly because not totally. You know, the decline in median income. Forget average income. You know, you see reported in the press average income. Well, that factors in and averages out this escalation in high-end salaries and even high-end working class, you know, working in tech and so forth, wage gains. At the middle, the median is the more important and below, because that's where the working class is. That's where the white working class, the median, has been harmed the most. Not to say that the ethnic working class in the U.S. has not been very often below the median, and of course they're getting whacked too. But now for the first time in the last decade, it's the median and above white working class that's getting hammered. And a lot of that has to do with free trade. Now, how does free trade impact jobs and wages? Well, in a couple of ways. One, free trade means you get more imports into the country. And if you get more imports into the country, that means those imports are going to displace the production of the same kinds of goods that was occurring in the U.S., so you have job loss. Right. Oh, and free trade says, well, but, you know, you have, conversely, you have more exports from the U.S. to these other free trade partners, and therefore jobs rise in export industries, even as jobs decline in import industries. And for those jobs that still remain in both the import and export sector, right, wages will fall in the import-affected industries, and wages will rise in the export. That's the argument, right? The net effect is what they say is positive from free trade for all parties. You know, that's the ideology. Well, it's not true. Right? If you look at what's happened in the U.S. with free trade, NAFTA, and so on and so forth, we've lost more jobs than we've gained. And the jobs that have been left, the wages have fallen more in those import-affected areas than they have risen in the export areas. So we've had a net loss of jobs and a net decline in remaining wages. That's the legacy of free trade, you see. And this whole idea that all parties benefit, you know, free trade raises all boats, is nonsense. When you look at it from a distribution point of view, who does it benefit? Okay, so maybe, you know, U.S. corporations benefit from free trade, but that doesn't mean their workers benefit. Oh, but what about all this Trade Assistance Adjustment Act that we have? You know, we have legislation to help workers lose their jobs and so forth from free trade. Well, it's a measly $600 million, half of which is only claimed, which is 0.002% of U.S. GDP. It's a fig leaf, you say, Trade Assistance Act. That's nonsense. You know, it's nothing for the effects that occur from free trade in the U.S. So we have this problem of net loss of jobs and net reduction of wages. Free trade results from this export-import effect from free trade. Ah, but free trade is not just trade in goods and services, you see. When you talk about exports-imports, so far we've been talking about the negative net effect on wages and jobs from goods and services. Goods flow, services flow between these countries that parties free trade. Ah, but free trade is about financial flows. If you look at NAFTA, you know, there's more discussion and provisions in NAFTA to ensure U.S. investment out of the U.S. into Mexico and Canada, particularly Mexico, than there is about goods and service flows. Free trade is about foreign direct investment, and the U.S. always is more concerned about the FDI, foreign direct investment, opportunities in these countries that are free trade partners. So free trade means job offshoring, you see, when they corporations, multinational corporations, instead of investing and expanding operations production in the U.S., they do it in Mexico. That means the jobs are created in Mexico, not here in the U.S. A good example is this company in auto industry, Delphi, auto parts manufacturer, used to have over 100,000 jobs in the U.S. Well, moved all of those jobs to Mexico. It's one of the largest manufacturers, over 100,000 employees in Mexico now. And then, of course, any future job growth occurs in Mexico instead of in the U.S. Okay, so job offshoring is a second derivative consequence of free trade. of the specifically the money flows provisions in free trade agreements, not just the goods flows, which seems to get the attention. So we have a double effect here, you know, of net effect from free trade, export, import on wages and jobs, but we also have a big effect on job offshoring and job loss and wage loss as a result. So it's income flows and goods flows that are the concern here in free trade. Okay, so what is Trump really saying? And what's wrong with his free trade provisions? Well, first of all, he says, we're going to tear up NAFTA. Well, what does he mean by tearing up NAFTA? I mean, that's a pretty ambiguous term. Is he simply going to throw out the whole trade treaty? Well, he can't. He doesn't have the authority to do that. No president does, you see, because it's been signed and approved by the Senate. It's a treaty, you see, and he knows that. Oh, he says he's going to impose tariffs on Mexico and China, 45% tariff on Chinese imports and 35% tariff on Mexican imports in the U.S. Well, he doesn't have presidential authority to do that either. Under the 1974 Trade Act, a president can only impose change or raise tariffs by 15% for 150 days. After that, it must be part of Congress. Congress must legislate. Okay. Okay, so what about, oh, he says China is a currency manipulator. No, China isn't a currency manipulator. Over a decade now, China has pegged with a range its currency to the U.S. dollar and a basket of other goods. And China's currency has fluctuated up and down in this narrow range very little. Who are the big currency manipulators? Japan and Europe. Well, we don't say anything about them, do we? Right. The Japanese yen has depreciated against the dollar by over 20% in recent years as a result of QE and monetary policy driving the currency down, and the same in Europe with, to a lesser extent, the euro. So they're the big manipulators, but you don't hear the U.S. elites talking about that, do you? No, they talk about China, and China's not the problem in terms of currency manipulation. Well, what's he planning, Trump planning to do about China and Europe as currency manipulators? Well, nothing. I haven't been able to find anything in his statement about it. Nor do I hear anything about the tax policies that are designed to provide an incentive to U.S. multinational corporations to offshore. You see, we've had this for some time since Reagan, this tax policy that gives a big investment tax credit to U.S. multinationals if they invest in new plant and equipment, even if they do it offshore, you see. Yeah, not just in the U.S., now it's offshore. It was originally back under Kennedy, investment tax credit. You had to show that you had, you, the company, that you had actually invested in plant and equipment and hired people onshore. Well, under Nixon, they took away the having to prove. And then under Reagan, they took away wherever you invest. So it's actually a tax cut, a subsidization to companies to move offshore. He's not talking anyway, Trump, about offshoring, job offshoring, or the taxation that subsidizes offshoring. Which leads me to believe that, you know, a lot of this position on free trade is pandering by Trump. Just as Obama pandered, said, oh, you know, NAFTA in 2008 was a big problem, and he was going to revisit NAFTA, and he was going to change NAFTA, and then what did he do? He became the biggest free trader of all the presidents in the last 30 years. Look, these politicians tell people what they want to hear with having no intent of doing it. They're just inveterate liars of the elites. And I don't trust a billionaire to really care much about working class interests. I think he, like others, are just pandering. Telling people what they want to hear about free trade. And I don't believe Hillary either. I don't believe Hillary has any intent of opposing TPP. But I watch for a big push right after the election. They're going to try to push TPP through Congress in the last month, December here. Because they know they may have problems after that. Okay, so to sum up, right? Tear up and after. No explanation what he means by that. Tariffs on China and Mexico, can't do that, and he knows it, right? China, currency manipulator, no. Japan and Europe are currency manipulators. No talk about that, right? What about this Mexican wall, right? Well, the problem isn't low-wage people coming into the U.S., service people from Latin America. The problem is educated engineers and so forth coming in from Asia, from India, from China, and other places like that on H-1B visas and L-1 visas taking U.S. jobs in the high-tech sector where things pay well, you know? Well, what's his position on H-1B visas and L-1 visas, you know, for engineers and so forth coming into the country and staying here? Well, I don't hear anything about that either. I don't believe him there either, right? And then we got the tax policy, right? That's, in a sense, a de facto incentive for more offshoring. All right, these are the realities behind these politicians and free trade, but nonetheless, elections are done by perceptions, or won by perceptions, not reality. And right now, Trump is in these key swing states, is either even with Hillary or leading Hillary, Pennsylvania, Ohio. You know, if you can't win Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, you can't win the Electoral College the way it's set up. And right now, he's tied or ahead, despite what the elites say, you know, and trying to make him look like he is crazy, which he is, but crazy like a fox. Okay, so next week we're going to try to revisit what's going on with the French labor strikes against labor reforms in France. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.